This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on trails, events, festivals, gear, science, and more. Last week I said you wouldn't want to miss the podcast, and you won't this week either, because you can save some money, because one of our guests today is offering a discount code off their products. He'll probably change his mind if I mess his name up, though. And before I go off on a tangent, I'll let you know what's on the podcast this week. We're talking hemp shoes with Portuguese company 8000 Kicks, and we're talking about the recent maps published by Transport for London and about walking in the capital. This podcast is number 18, which makes the assumption I've not skipped a number somehow. It's going out on the 4th of July, which is of course Independence Day, and a lot of people just call it the 4th. It's a lot easier. It was also Canada Day this week, so I wore my Canada hockey jersey. It was far too hot, so I switched into my Blue Jays shirt, although not the red one that they only wear on July the 1st, because I couldn't find that one. Anyway, other than Independence Day in the US, what else can I tell you about July the 4th that you really didn't know and probably also didn't want to know? Well, it's Caesar Salad Day. It's Invisible Day, which I didn't see coming, and I hate to say it, but it's also Comic Sans Day, the font that people love to hate. Maybe it's just those of us that work in publishing and design that have an opinion on it. Maybe just nobody cares. I certainly fall into that dislike category, along with quite a few other fonts. They're the ones that whenever I see them in magazines or CD covers, they make me cringe. It's also the date in 1862 that Lewis Carroll, not his real name, created Alice in Wonderland. I thought about writing a book about walking blisters in Wearside called Callus in Sunderland. It's probably not going to sell. It's always a challenge with birthdays because this podcast is listened to far beyond the UK. So if I name a UK celebrity, probably no idea who they are in the US or Canada, and vice versa. There are a few that you may know, George Everest, who had a mountain named after him. Yes, Ben George. And then there was also Garibaldi and the singer Bill Withers. School's done here in Scotland for the summer, and we're already seeing more caravans and vehicles around, and along with that comes roadworks with those temporary traffic lights that you're not sure if they've actually recognised that your car is there. We did plan on going out filming this week, but the forecast kept changing. I've got no problem walking in the rain, but it does limit the ability to use cameras. Although last night at home the rain was a bit more biblical, so I don't think it would have damaged the equipment, I think it would have washed it into the next county. I know a lot of equipment is supposed to be waterproof, but Having said that, I really don't like getting it wet. Let's move on to the real content. Last time we talked about why Brighton and Hove is such a great place for walking with the city's walking officer, Delphine Jacques. And we talked footwear, walking and Japanese walking with Melissa McDowell from Gate Happens. This week it's hemp shoes and London Tube Station walking maps, among other things. But of course, first we take a quick look at some of this week's articles on walkingpost.com. Having been in the media industry for way too long, probably 30 years or more, the worst periods for news are generally midsummer and the week after Christmas. But we did manage to get some news for you for this week. If you do have news or spot some news that you think would be a good fit, or if you have guest ideas or comments, please do get in touch via walkingpost.com. Or you can just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. And of course, I should add that if you're from a company that wants to either advertise or sponsor the podcast, we're happy to hear from you too. So it's time for our almost brief recap of some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. In London, Chelsea Waterfront has opened a new stretch of Thames Path. In Atlanta, Georgia, a new segment of 22-mile trail has opened. And Mid-Suffolk has provided £3 million in funding for a scheme to link villages. Hounslow Council is looking to encourage more walking. The Bruce Trail in Canada has completed an invasive species project, and two-thirds of the King Charles III English Coastal Path, with the easy-to-remember initials of KC3ECP, is now open as the Isle of Sheppey section has been completed. The European Trails and Paths Conference is taking place in October in Italy. Walking and cycling routes have been upgraded in Droylsden and Audenshaw, and Worcester is planning to encourage active travel. You can read all of these and more at walkingpost.com. As I mentioned at the top of this episode, we have two interviews for you this week. A little later, we'll be talking about the new maps in London and schemes to get more people walking there. But first, stay tuned for an offer. We featured a few companies that attended the outdoor show in Liverpool last month, and one of those was 8000 Kicks, which produces hemp shoes made from industrial hemp. Industrial hemp's been used since around 8000 BC, give or take an hour, and its properties include being antibacterial, needing no fertilizers, and very little water to grow. 8000 Kicks is a pioneer in the development of hemp with the goal of showcasing its flexibility in a wide range of products. The company's got a store in Portugal but also sells online with products including men's and women's shoes, backpacks, socks, masks, wallets, bags and hats. At the show, we chatted with the company and set up an interview online with João Matos, business developer at 8000 Kicks. So maybe then we could start if you can tell me a bit about the history of the company and what the name means.
Yeah, so two different things. The history of the company is a funny one. It started in 2019, or actually the idea came in 2018, and this was with Bernardo, our founder. He had just came back to Portugal from London, where he was working for a few years, and he actually wanted to create a new company. And at 5 a.m. in the morning, some drinks, some fun times in the middle, someone suggested, oh, you should make a cannabis shoe as a joke. There was actually something very interesting about that because he'd seen hemp products in the past. And there is one very cool thing about hemp. It is the most durable natural fiber, only compared to spider web, which is way tougher to process in the end of the day. And it's also considered one of the most sustainable fibers, plants, because it, a few reasons. So it just grows. That's why weave is called weave, because hemp used to, and this was a worldwide thing since thousands of years ago. Hemp just grew out there. It doesn't need to be watered. Grows fast, replenishes the soil, and gives you a very tough fiber that's very durable. So headpipe has always been used for ropes, clothes, the ship sails on the ships during the 14th, 15th, 1600s. Everything was made out of hemp. And the main source of paper for at least 1,000 years was also hemp. Everything changed in the mid-20th century because they say there was some lobbying against hemp, so it was almost forgotten. But now that everyone is looking for more sustainable, more eco-conscious, eco-friendly products, we realized that hemp is just not being used, but it's out there. It's still out there. And some people were never stopped developing the technology to make a good fabric. So, and this is where the name of the brand comes from. We actually started as Dope Kicks, which is a dope name, but it led to some problems with advertising. But we had to switch. So we chose 8,000 kicks because hemp has been used for at least 8,000 years by humans. It's hard to figure out if it's even older than that, because in the end of the day, the fabrics will just turn into dust after thousands of years. So we don't know exactly how long it's been used. And kicks, of course, because our products just kick ass, as they usually say. So this is where everything comes from. When Bernardo realized there was something here, he went to his grandmother, who worked for over 50 years in the textile industry in a small Portuguese town where our headquarters are based. He told her, "Hey, grandmother, I want to make a hemp shoe." At first, she wasn't so into that. She didn't want to be involved with drugs or anything, which proves the misconception that was out there around hemp. But then he ordered some fabric samples. She looked into it. She said, "Okay, this is actually very durable. This is actually very strong." And in the beginning, grandma was very important to help us figure out how to make a proper shoe, a proper backpack, how to deal with factories, because that was her experience. And now she helps us a lot with marketing still, and welcomes us in her home every time we're together, which is a very warm welcoming at the end of the day.
And it's not just shoes that you make, though, is it? You have other products as well?
Yeah, so we have shoes and backpacks, but we also do some smaller accessories like socks, wallets, fanny packs, hats. We've been trying some different things, and I promise we will keep trying to do new stuff. We had a line of dog toys, actually.
What makes hemp such a good material?
So in the end of the day, it's mainly its durability. It's very, very strong. Of course, there are some challenges. Every fiber is different. One of the reasons why you don't see it so as available now is because, first thing is because it was banned for decades. And then because for that reason, the technology didn't move on. Hemp is very tough. It comes from the trunk of the plant. So we need tall plants so we get long fibers. And with these long fibers, we can make a proper fabric. However, because of its strengthness, the decortication process of the fiber is also a little bit tougher. So that shows the quality of the product, but also of the fiber, but also shows that it has some challenges. But mainly that's it. It's durability, the fact that it's also antibacterial, anti-humidity, so it takes a long time to soak if you put it on water, and that's why it was used for ship sails and ship ropes for a long time. But then as a plant, it also grows fast, replenishes the soil. So unlike a lot of crops where you plant something and then you cannot plant anything for months or years, with hemp it's actually the opposite. So it absorbs a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, releases a lot of minerals, leaves them on the ground.
Are all your products made in Portugal?
No. We tried a lot of different countries, different products. So right now, the main challenge, as I was saying, is to do the decortication process, the spinning, so that you get a wholesome fabric. Because a canvas fabric is as strong as its weakest link. And in the end, what we're trying to do here is prove that you can do with hemp things that you cannot do with other natural fibers, like cotton. So more durable products like running shoes, hiking shoes, travel backpacks that won't break. And for that, we need the decortication process is super important because you need every fiber to be the same thickness, the same length, and that's what gives it the strength. So because we stopped using hemp for decades in the Western world, basically, the technology to make this fabric is still a few years behind what the Chinese in specific are doing now. So the Chinese have perfected the genetics of the plants. So they have crops for decades now that produce long fibers. The decortication machines, they developed it themselves with the help of Americans. So the fabric, we produce it there. We tried using fabric that we've made in Europe for as well, but it just didn't have enough durability. And if it's not durable, it just goes against what we're trying to prove here. So the highest quality comes from there. And then technical products like the backpacks or hiking or running shoes, this is an expertise of the Chinese manufacturers. So we use it as well. Right now we do a model of Chelsea boots, still in Portugal. Boots are one of the products that Portuguese are experts on. But mainly here, we're used to working with leather, and now the so-called vegan leather as well, products. That would be the main expertise.
And what's the reason why people should think about buying hemp shoes?
Well, if you do care about wearing something that is natural but still very durable, if you notice that you go out in a store for your next walking shoes or hiking shoes, you'll notice that everything there is made of plastic. There's also a good reason for that, is because all the other common natural fibers are not strong enough to last through the challenges that this type of footwear must last. But now there's an alternative, which is hemp. It's a fiber that was super important throughout human history, and it's just coming back. It's better to wear something natural in the end of the day because of the way it decomposes in the atmosphere. What we're doing to the planet, the fact that we're planting more hemp trees, which is very important, and the fact that in the end of the day, it's a cool story, because you get to the family gathering on Christmas and you say, hey, have you checked my cannabis shoes? Everyone, you'll be the star. but that's it. We try to combine the functionality of the shoes, some smart features such as step-in systems, very lightweight and comfortable shoes, with this unique material. This makes it, in the end of the day, a totally unique product that you can buy and you can use it for going to the mountains, straight to a meeting, because design-wise, they're also very, very versatile.
And you can make them waterproof and antibacterial and all kinds of things, I guess.
Most of our models are waterproof, real waterproof. And then the fact that we use hemp insoles, for example, on the shoes, makes it more hygienic because it's antibacterial, anti-humidity. So there's another advantage there.
And they're good for walking in, like hiking?
Oh, they're amazing. You guys can check in the reviews online, but I would say the things that the customers like the most about our shoes, it's the comfort. It's really the comfort. They have durable soles, nice cushions. Of course, we have different styles with different shapes.
Where can you buy your shoes? Can you buy them anywhere in the world?
Yeah, so you can buy it anywhere in the world from the website. We ship to the UK as well. We ship it from Portugal for now, but soon we hope to get the products also in some of the UK retailers. We had very, very interesting conversations in Liverpool, and I think that people do understand the vision that we have here, because we have a product that will be completely unique on the shelves. But for now, you can get it from our website. Jim, we didn't speak about this, but we can send a promo code that you can put on the description of the video or something, so that your audience can also get a discount for our products.
Yeah, that sounds good. Great. Thank you. You were mentioning the show in Liverpool. That was a good show for you?
Yes, it was our first time in showing the product in the UK. Overall, we're happy. We made good contacts with stores, good contacts with the distribution, and also even people like designers or people just curious that stopped by were very impressed with the products. So that's a good start. you never get into a market for the first time with a new product, a new brand, and just sell everything. But the most important part was to see that there's a lot of interest, some people buying samples as well. We're very happy.
How often do you introduce new products into your line?
So every year we bring 2 to 3 new styles. Could be 2 styles of shoes, could be 1 style of shoes and a backpack. And I can say already there's something coming. We have a new summer outdoor shoe coming on, very similar to our tracker in the line of the sole, but then with a knitted fabric that makes it more durable and some design details to make you stand out a little bit if that's what you want. And it's just, but you can pick the right color. Later this year, we'll bring on the Panier 3-in-1 backpack. So it will be a Panier backpack that you can attach to your bike, but you can also use as a messenger bag or turn it into a backpack. It will be very interesting. It's going to be on Kickstarter, which is a big thing for us. It allows us to put out products, get the validation from the customers before we produce, and get some pre-orders as well. So that's very cool. So we have a lot of things to announce. Also working on the styles for winter 2026. But this is where we're heading. So you can expect from us more styles that are versatile and outdoors without being too technical. We're not competing with performance brands. So people who compete in some type of outdoors activities or running, probably not going to buy our products. But if you do it as a hobby and you want something that is durable and versatile and natural, that's where you can find it. It's with us.
So there you go, a great interview and a discount code for our listeners to get 15% off 8000 Kicks shoes and boots and backpacks and all the rest of the products. Just go to 8000kicks.com and enter the promo code WALKINGPOST15. No spaces or hyphens or anything, just WALKINGPOST15, and you'll get 15% off. Simple. There's also details on the podcast website at walkingpost.com. So, thanks a lot to 8000 Kicks for that. Next, it's to London. Maybe I'm different, but I've always walked as much as possible when I lived a short tube ride from London, because I like to see things, mostly. Even my son enjoys walking around London. One day, because he likes flags so much, we walked around to find embassies with flags. I was a bit disappointed that Canada House and Trafalgar Square didn't have any of the provincial flags out, like it used to when I was in the process of moving there. Maybe they do that normally, and maybe they just change them for the day, I have no idea why. Anyway, London, in spite of the ease of getting around by public transport, is a great place for walking. And I don't just mean the centre. A few weeks ago we ran an article that Transport for London has created a series of new maps showing the walking times and distances between stations, encouraging people to consider walking as part of their journey and reap the benefits of travelling on foot. There are other maps, so to tell us about them all and about the importance of walking to TFL, we chatted with Alexandra Goodship, Head of Transport Strategy and Planning at Transport for London.
I guess then, to get things started, if we could maybe talk a bit about the importance of walking and the overall plan for London.
Yeah, and so, I mean, walking's absolutely key to the Mayor's transport strategy. So we published that strategy back in 2018, and the overarching goal is for us to have 80% of trips in London made by walking, cycling and public transport, because we're trying to reduce overall reliance on private vehicles and promote a more kind of sustainable, healthy transport system. And underpinning that strategy is something called the Healthy Streets Approach, which is all about making London streets really inclusive and pleasant and attractive to walk and cycle and wait for the bus on and see your friends in and spend time on. So walking and the walking experience is absolutely key to all of that. And it might surprise some people, because I think people tend to think of London and they think of buses and they think of the tube. you know, obviously those modes play a really massive part in our transport system, but actually a quarter of all the way trips which are made every day in London are walking trips. And when you look at Londoners, that number increases to 37%. So it's a really important mode of transport for people living in London, but also working in London and visiting London. So making sure that walking experience is good is really important for us.
And I suppose there's also a combination of those. I imagine that people that take the tube or take the bus, that's not all they do. They probably walk as well.
That's right. So almost every public transport journey and most other journeys, in fact, in London will start and finish with a walking trip. So if you talk about the average underground trip, I think the walking trip that's associated with that averages about 11 minutes. So there's a lot of walking, which goes on as part of other journeys that people are making. Our transport strategy isn't just about the transport system. It's about the city as a whole and how it all works and the health of Londoners. And we have a target in our transport strategy, which is for all Londoners to do the 20 minutes of active travel that they need to do every day to stay healthy. The easiest way to do that is to integrate that activity into your daily routine. So to do it as part of your trip to work or as part of your trip to school, rather than, you know, trying to carve out time just to exercise, it's much easier just to weave it into the day. So again, walking is really important for those health outcomes for people living in London. And especially when you talk about children as well, because we have quite a significant obesity issue in London. A lot of London's children are leaving primary school overweight, particularly in areas of deprivation. And walking is free, so it's a really easy activity that everybody can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I know when plans come out, they don't just come out and then all of a sudden they end. It's obviously always a work in progress. How is that plan going so far?
So yeah, we're making really good progress. I mean, lots is happening in terms of making London a more walkable city. We work really closely with the London boroughs, and we give them funding every year for things to help make their streets healthier and to improve the street experience for everybody moving around the capital. So we do things like making junctions safer, creating more footway space, more pedestrian priority areas, better crossings. We change the traffic signals so that there's more time for people who are walking. It's quicker for them to get across the road. We've got programmes like School Streets, where we're changing the space outside of schools to make it a more walking friendly environment. And we have programmes we work with the boroughs where we put in dropped curbs, which are really important for people, you know, pushing pushchairs and using wheelchairs. So lots and lots going on. There's also a lot of activity around that interchange with the public transport network that you were mentioning. Making that as easy as possible for Londoners is really important. So we do things like improving the wayfinding around stations. We have the legible London wayfinding system in London so that it's really easy to find your way around when you're walking, and making bus stops and bus stations more accessible. We also do a lot of work with schools through a program called Travel for Life, where we encourage people to walk and cycle to school with their families. And we have a program of walking and cycling grants where we give communities budgets to do kind of grassroots initiatives to make walking and cycling something that can be done at that local community level.
Lots of work going on there. Now, what are the biggest challenges to getting more people walking?
So we do a lot of research and we get a lot of data back from our customers about what they think about the transport network in London. And the things that people tell us about walking is that they don't have time to walk, or that they're concerned about sort of motor traffic and the impact that that has in terms of noise or speed, or sort of feeling perhaps unsafe with some of the walking trips that they might want to make. They also talk about concerns about personal security. So it's really important for us to kind of work really closely with the Metropolitan Police, the City of London Police and the British Transport Police. And we have our own security teams as well, just to make the transport system feel really safe for everybody that wants to use it.
You think of some of these things as just being one aspect, but there's so many different facets to, as you were saying, drop curbs and traffic safety. There's so many aspects to it that you don't necessarily think about.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's why having that integrated transport strategy that walking sort of fits within is really important, because it's not just about introducing a wider pavement. It's about what does that whole transport system feel like? What does the street environment feel like? And how do people experience it? And just making sure all of that fits together and is really easy for people.
Right.
It's particularly important when you think that 80% of the public space in London is the streets. So if people are going to be enjoying that public space and using that public space, how that space is set up for them is really, really critical.
And there's also the aspect of, you know, sometimes you might be walking down one of the really busy streets like Regent Street, and all you want to do is cross over to get away from all of the people on one side, but you can't because it's so busy. So, you know, it's making some of those transitions from one side of a street to the other easier, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, pedestrian crossings is really important, because you might be in those really busy environments and wanting to cross the road, but you also might be out in, you know, outer London with quite a busy main road running through an area where you live. So introducing pedestrian crossings in those places is really important to reduce what we call that severance from one side of the road to the other. There's also a lot of work going on to pedestrianise streets. So I was in Camden last week where they've just pedestrianised Camden High Street. So there's more and more of that pedestrian space being created as well.
Right. Is there any pushback to that at all?
Well, I mean, all of these schemes, you have to kind of really carefully consider what the impacts are going to be. And you have to consider things like freight and servicing and, you know, how people are going to cycle through an area, what it might mean for the journey times for people on buses. So there's a lot of careful consideration goes into all the schemes just to ensure that they can work as well as they possibly can.
Sure. I guess a lot of that is communication as well. But are there any stats on walking in London? How many people do walk?
About, I think it's 6.7 million walking trips every day in London. Absolutely huge number. And when we look at what those walking trips are for, it really varies. So you get some which are leisure trips. So that's either walking for leisure or walking to a leisure destination. So that's about 37%. Then you get people walking for shopping and personal business, which is about 26%. Walking to education, 12%, and then the rest are for sort of work and escorting other people and things like that. Quite a range of different kinds of journey happening on foot. It's also interesting that about a third of the trips that are made by car or as a passenger in a car could be walked in less than 25 minutes. So we could do a lot to reduce the impact of traffic and to reduce congestion if we all walked a few more of some of those journeys.
I would imagine much less frustration and better for your mental health as well.
That's right. I mean, the health benefits of walking are very well documented, but it has really wide-ranging health benefits, not just for your mental health, but also in helping to prevent things like diabetes and heart disease, Alzheimer's, colon cancer and depression. So the health benefits are huge. And that's why that healthy streets approach is so front and centre of our transport strategy.
That transport strategy that's aiming for 80% of journeys to be on foot and by bike and public transport, how much is walking central to that?
We have an overarching target that doesn't sort of split it between the different modes, but it's that 80% of the trips being walked, cycled or using public transport. And then we also have a target which is around Vision Zero for road danger. So we want to have nobody being killed or seriously injured on our transport network by 2041. So those are the kind of two key overarching goals of the transport strategy. And then sitting underneath that, we have a whole load of kind of delivery plans, including our walking action plan and our leisure walking plan as well. That's the sort of strategic framework in which we're moving forward.
Excellent. How many, I mean, you might not know because it's a big project, but how many people would be involved in a big project like that?
Oh, so in developing the walking plans, they get led out of my team, which is the transport policy team at Transport for London. But we work really closely with colleagues right across the business. So colleagues in engineering, colleagues in marketing, but also with our stakeholder community. So lots of different charities and organisations which are interested in creating that walking environment, making it better in London, come together and help us with lots of ideas.
The most recent thing I think that happened was the maps that were recently published. Could you tell me a little bit about those and why they were introduced and what the different features are of each of them?
Yeah, so we recently published some maps showing the walking distances between different tube and national rail stations in central London. There's one for the West End, where many of us see a show and eat out. One for the City of London, where obviously lots of people travel for work. And then another sort of overarching one for zones 1 and 2 of London. And it just shows on the maps, it shows how long it takes to walk between the stations in those areas. A lot of the stations have, you know, between a sort of 6 and 15 minute walk between them. So a lot of those journeys, you could just get off the tube a bit early, particularly if there's disruption or it's very crowded, and just do the last bit of your journey by walking rather than making that change to a different tube line or a change from National Rail to tube. It's one of those funny things where the tube map is really incredible in terms of finding a way around the tube network, but it does sort of lead to us sometimes having a slightly distorted view of the geography of London and not quite knowing exactly where places are in relation to each other, even if you've lived in London for a really long time. So these maps sort of just help people to overcome that and to really understand how close some of the stations are. And then, of course, if you get off the station early and or don't make that last change on the tube, the health benefits for that are huge, because you only have to do 20 minutes of active travel a day to have an enormous difference to your health.
And sometimes that could even be as little as saying, well, I'm going to walk to that station because then I don't need to change to the Northern line. I'm already directly on it. So
yeah, exactly. You don't need to make that one change, that you might just go one stop and you just don't need to do it.
I know when I moved to London for my second university degree, this was the days of the A to Z. So everybody walked around with an A to Z. But at that time, it was always you were looking around thinking, OK, how quick is it to get to the next station or whatever? So
yeah.
I think it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, no, they're really, really useful. And I mean, every time I look at them, there's something new that strikes me, like, oh, really? Is that close to that other place? So yeah, they're very, very useful. They've also been done working with our independent disability advisory group. So we've marked on the maps where there's particularly long, steep inclines, so that people know about that if they want to use the routes and they've got some mobility challenges. But also we've chosen routes where the pavements are a bit wider so that they're as accessible as possible.
The only thing that it doesn't mention is sometimes once you get into a tube station, it can be about an 8 or 9 minute walk along those big long corridors.
But that's another reason to sometimes to sort of pop up onto the surface rather than making that last change, because it might not actually be that big a difference in terms of journey time.
How are they being received so far?
Really well. So they were published in May and they've already been downloaded more than 1,500 times. And since we told everyone about them, the visits to the walking page have gone up by 50%. So there's definitely lots and lots of interest. And I'm sure lots of people will be making the most of them. On our website, we've also got some other walks that people might find interesting as well. So we've got, for example, the Green Link Walk connecting Epping Forest and Peckham, the Capital Ring Walk, which circles the city and takes in plenty of green spaces like Sion Park and Walthamstow Marshes. And those walks are also split into sections, so you can just sort of pick bits of them. So there's lots on the website that people might be interested to see.
I guess momentum is quite an important thing to keep it in people's minds. How often do you introduce something new, like even if it's just a different walk on the website, as you mentioned, or publications or that kind of thing?
Yeah, we sort of try to add things on there. And again, we work with our stakeholders to add new bits on as well. We're working on a new walking action plan because the first one is beginning to get towards the end of its lifespan now. So we'll have new plans and new initiatives that we'll set out in that as well. And then really it's just about all of that stuff that we're delivering on street, either us or the London boroughs, just to make that walking environment as good as it possibly can be.
I know there are tons of walking books on London. There's one that's, I think, 4 volumes, and it's just got hundreds and hundreds of walks. And these days you can also download apps. So there's tons of walking opportunities. What are some of the ones that you particularly like, or that people, I mean, obviously the obvious ones like Hyde Park and St. James's Park and along the river, but are there any kind of hidden ones that you like?
Yeah, so I think the walk I do most often. So I actually don't live in London myself, but I often bring my daughter, who's disabled, up to St Thomas's Hospital to go to medical appointments, and she's in a wheelchair. So what we normally do is go to Blackfriars and then we walk along the river to get to St Thomas's. So that's a walk I do a lot, and it's lovely. And yes, it's very well used, that space. But just walking, you know, after you've had a difficult medical appointment, and, you know, just being able to clear your head, it's incredibly good. And you really do experience those mental health benefits doing something like that. I also did a little canvas of the team before I joined you this afternoon to see what some of their favourite walks were. My colleague Jack loves the River Lee marshes. So he starts at the Millfields Park in Clapton and makes his way along the River Lee via the filter beds and across the Hackney marshes, and follows the riverside path along to the tunnel under Lee Bridge Road and into the Walthamstow marshes. And then from there, he wanders along the towpath and through the fields where you can see the cows. Not a very common sight in London, but there are still places where you can do things like this, and ends up in the cafe across the bridge next to the rowing club. So that's a really nice one that he likes to do. And then my colleague Winsome, she's a big fan of the Waterlink Way. So she goes from the Poole River, along the Poole River from Beckenham to Lewisham. And she starts at Ravensbourne Station. And then there's also a spur you can do up to Beckenham Place Park from there as well. And then my colleague Adam is a big fan of the Parkland Walk, which connects Highgate and Finsbury Park and goes along an abandoned railway, which has been transformed into London's longest linear nature reserve. So there's a few ideas for you and your listeners.
Yeah, perfect. There's just so many options. And I know it's urban walking, but some of the ones that you just mentioned are, you kind of get away from that urban kind of feeling as well. So
yeah. And, you know, the good thing about walking in an urban environment is it does tend to be really accessible. So, you know, traipsing across the fields with my daughter is really difficult, but actually walking around the city with her is much easier because the walks do tend to be much more accessible. So there's lots of advantages, I think, to urban walking.
Yeah, definitely. And you can also use tube stations as a starting point for some of those walks that you just mentioned as well. It's not difficult to get to a lot of walks if you were going to do it for leisure.
Exactly. Yeah, they're all really well connected, and you can do short walks, you can do long walks. You know, you're never going to be far from a tube station or a bus stop or a railway station. And so you can change your plans really easily as well, which is really helpful, I think, when you're traveling with children.
I do love London, and I really do enjoy walking there. When I first moved there, the way you got around was either by remembering places, or pretty much everyone carried a very well-used A to Z to find their way around. Now you can just use your phone and have it tell you where to make turns. Not as much fun, but still useful to have interactive maps right in front of you. I'm actually not sure what my favourite walk in London would be, there are just too many. Maybe ones that go past used record stores or markets. Or rivers or trees. There's always something to see or do. No London for me this weekend. I'm going to do something I rarely do these days, and that's go to a concert. Hopefully it's loud enough that I don't fall asleep once I get past my regular bedtime. And hopefully it's a good one. I do miss playing, though. Well, that's it for another podcast. If you have news, suggestions for podcast guests, anything, please do get in touch through jim@walkingpost.com. So I hope you enjoyed this week's walkingpost.com podcast, and I hope that you have a great week, hopefully with a walk somewhere, even if it's to get to public transport. And don't forget that 8000 Kicks discount code, walkingpost15 at the checkout at 8000kicks.com. So until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.